We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
This is Multipolarity, charting the rise of the new multipolar world order.
Coming up this week.
New research from Bloomberg says that Beijing is steering the Chinese economy away from the recent real estate boom and into high-tech manufacturing. It's a drive estimated to be worth 19% of GDP by 2026. Running the numbers, not only is China collapse theory once again proved false, the market may even have underpriced how much gas there is still in the tank.
Meanwhile, the Francis Scott Key Bridge has collapsed, effectively blockading the Baltimore port for a long time to come. The $80 billion in cargo and 140,000 jobs tied to it is bad enough. But the blow to US pride might turn out to be even worse. Across the country, infrastructure is crumbling, while replacing it is becoming ever more expensive.
Finally, as the US Fed debt pile moves toward 100% of GDP, warnings are being sounded about an American Liz Truss moment. Trussification has become a byword for politicians being strung up by the bond markets. The only questions outstanding are, who exactly is the truss who is about to be strung up, and who is organizing the stringing?
But first,
Sino More.
As listeners will know, much of the financial press in the West has been talking fairly consistently over the last 6 months or so about difficulties that the Chinese economy is having, that growth is not what it ought to be, that indeed the whole thing might be collapsing and coming to a halt. And yet news emerged, a little heralded, available for those who follow these things on Twitter from the correct accounts, that the New York Fed had undertaken analysis as to what would happen if a Chinese manufacturing surge took hold and what effect that would have on the US economy. And indeed, the Fed found that such a scenario would lead to inflation and require higher interest rates because of all of the raw materials that such a boom would take, and thus the increased commodities prices around the world. So if the press are saying that the Chinese economy is in serious trouble, why on earth is the New York Fed talking about, you know, taking time to analyze the potential for a Chinese manufacturing boom? Well, the answer might have come from a Bloomberg report on some analysis from Bloomberg Economics, which is Bloomberg's kind of in-house macroeconomics and financial analysts team. And they found actually that what China is doing at the moment is it's trying to shift investment from the real estate sector, which by all accounts had become over-leveraged and over-invested, and move instead into a much higher productivity area, i.e. high-tech manufacturing. And this report by Bloomberg Economics found that, or estimated that by 2026, in just 2 years' time, high-end manufacturing could account for 19% of GDP, which would be up from 14% this year, which is a huge growth in manufacturing when you consider the Chinese economy, even at these supposedly in serious trouble levels, is at 4, 5, 6% per annum. Now, the areas that they looked at in this report were medicine, advanced equipment, IT, communication equipment and services, as well as research and development, R&D. So these are areas which are, you know, all very important for 21st century manufacturing. Bloomberg Economics believes that these will grow really significantly in terms of their size. And indeed, then a day or two after that, there was a longer report in the Financial Times, which discussed the fact that the Chinese are really pushing this. It's an actual policy to push investment away from housing and toward this new manufacturing, and that the technology and growth is leading not just to an increase in manufacturing, but also in productivity gains elsewhere. So we have said for a long time, I know producer Gavin doesn't like us patting ourselves on the back, but we've been saying for a long time that at the very least, the narrative in the Western press that the Chinese economy was somehow collapsing, that it was in serious trouble, that it was in terminal decline, that it had perhaps peaked as a growth story, was strange to say the least, because there wasn't much evidence in that. We were further arguing, in fact, that the supposed collapse in the housing market was probably a deliberate effort to take the juice out of that sector and move it toward more productive sectors. And indeed, now it seems that this is something that is in fact happening. We're now seeing a kind of a slow and belated recognition that this was the plan all along. Does this mean that the Chinese are all powerful, that they're all knowing, that there's some kind of super breed of highly intelligent people who can manage an economy? Well, no, not necessarily. But if you were looking at Chinese policy, that's exactly what that suggested would happen. And indeed, now we're getting recognition of that. And this is going to be the new growth model. It's going to be manufacturing. And specifically, it's going to be moving up the manufacturing chain.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say about it is we've been covering the Chinese slowdown, Chinese crash story, whatever you want to call it, for the past couple of months. It's kind of annoying. It's kind of annoying that the financial press and so on were spinning these yarns. The Chinese continuously told them that what they were saying was not accurate. They said, no, well, you would say that, blah, blah, blah. Although, you know, the same publications, when the IMF turns around or the European Central Bank or someone like that turns around and tells them about what's going on in the economy, they, of course, they go, well, that's what's going on in the economy. So that's sort of irritating. The other thing that is huge changes have been going on in China for some time now. We've talked about them on the show before, but the reason that the press are now paying attention to them, I think, is because they're being crystallized. China are now figuring out a way to communicate them and to underline their importance. So just to give a sense, in that FT article that you were talking about, they referred to the fact that Xi Jinping toured China's central Hunan province last week. He gave talks to local leaders, as leaders often do, and he said that the plans were, quote unquote, to develop the new quality productive forces. This is kind of typical Chinese bureaucratic, quasi-Marxist bureaucratic jargon, I suppose. Those kind of phrases are very important in Chinese politics. Some people can find them a little bit alien, unusual, but we often have these phrases as well embedded in our politics about, you know, where the general direction of the country or the program is going to go, and we think they're totally normal. Maybe the language throws us off in these cases, I don't know. But the article refers to a 6,000-word essay published by the state news agency as Jinhu, and what the essay is conveying, first of all, it uses that phrase multiple times, but in addition to that, it's trying to convey that Xi Jinping's economic reform program is comparable in importance to that of Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping famously is the Chinese leader who basically liberalized certain aspects of the Chinese economy, allowed market forces in, and so on. And basically, Deng is seen as the big architect of the present Chinese economy. So what's being signaled out of China, and again, okay, fair enough, Xi is now using this terminology and these essays are now being written, but I think that these trends have been obvious for a while and have only been ignored because of, frankly, the incompetence of the financial press. Basically, what this is it's exactly what you said. They are going to focus not just on manufacturing itself, obviously. They're going to focus specifically on very high end. Right now, that means stuff like solar panels, batteries for electric cars themselves. We can discuss that technology, whether it'll be viable in the future or so on. But the important aspect of it is basically that the general consensus at the moment is that together with AI, the electric car trend, I suppose, is going to be the future of the world. Now, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but right now everyone believes that. So building those things is the tip of the technological sphere. It's a bit like iPhone or smartphone production maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And China are trying to be the world leader in that industry. And frankly, it looks like they might be succeeding. So this is their new strategy. They no longer, as the article says, just want to copy technology. They no longer want to just catch up with the West. They want to compete the West. And this has been a long time coming, and it relates to a strategy where they're going to sell these new products. They may sell them to the West if we allow it. There was a headline in the FT today saying that the projection is, I think by next year, 25% of electric vehicles sold in Europe will be Chinese. They may not be allowed to do that. That may trigger a protectionist wave in Europe, which will have consequences for European competitiveness and for the European economy. But the point is that they are going to sell these where they can sell them. But their plan is, I think, that they can't really rely on the West anymore as a partner in relatively open trade. And so they are aiming at the developing world, and they want to sell these products to the developing world, and in doing so, sort of lift the developing world up, much like the United States did with a bombed out Europe after the Second World War. They sold us all those trucks and so on, lift things up. Just before handing it back to you, I will highlight a little quote from this Financial Times article, because I think it's kind of indicative of the general direction of this debate as we move forward. Quote, "For this to work, China must expand its share of global manufacturing. That needs to be accommodated by the rest of the world. The rest of the world is unlikely to do that," end quote, says Michael Pettis, a finance professor at Peking University. Obviously, we've talked about Michael Pettis extensively before. Michael Pettis is the perma bear on China, who apparently now is not any longer calling for a big crash in the world economy. Rather, he is saying that the rest of the world is not going to absorb Chinese manufacturing products. Whether that is true or not, we will leave up in the air. I think it's pretty clear that the West may try and shut down these products, which will be detrimental to them. But the rest of the world, I think, will accept them. I just think it's easy. It's interesting that Michael Pettis is clearly, being the arch China bear, got the message. He's got the message that we've been saying on the podcast for maybe 6 months, that all this slowdown stuff is rubbish, all this crash stuff is rubbish, and the real game that's being played right now is Chinese global market penetration with very high-end products.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about the manufacturing that they're going for and linking into that manufacturing strategy is that they're very much focused not on Europe and the United States, which have been their traditional markets, but on the global South, in inverted commas, those countries, those other countries in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in Central Asia, where, by the way, there was another Financial Times article recently showing that the Chinese are gaining extreme leverage in that part of the world in terms of their exports, but also places, essentially everywhere that's not the West. And you've highlighted before that if you look at Chinese export destinations, the West and the non-West are pretty much even. In fact, the non-West is moving slightly ahead, and that's right now. You know, as this strategy goes on, you know, it'll move well ahead, one would have thought. And that achieves two things. First of all, it reduces China's reliance on the West in the event that the West tries to coerce China into doing what the US wants, to do what Washington wants. But in addition to that, it hooks the Chinese manufacturing story to a much faster growing part of the world. The US has been growing fairly rapidly recently, but only on the back of really extreme fiscal deficits. You know, they've really been juicing the economy either through tax cuts in the Trump era or spending in the Biden era, both of which were unfunded. You know, Western Europe is not growing quickly, whereas places like Africa, to a certain degree, South America, certainly Central Asia and Southeast Asia are actually growing very quickly indeed. And the Chinese are kind of hooking themselves into that area and gaining dominance within those marketplaces. After that little bit of kind of positive spin, let's look at Michael Pettis's argument once again, and specifically as it relates to this story. So Pettis has always argued that China's chronic and large current account deficit, its trade deficit, is just as much a sign of a malformed economy as the US or Britain or Western Europe's trade deficit. So China, did I say deficit with China? I meant surplus. So China's got a constant trade and current account surplus, i.e. it's exporting more than it imports, or in another way, it's saving much more than it spends. And that excess savings is pushed out onto the rest of the world. China's essentially relying on the rest of the world's purchasing, its consumption, to fund China's own manufacturing growth. He argues that that is untenable over a long period of time. Pettis argues that ultimately this will have to unfurl, and the fact that the Chinese are having to take more and more debt to generate the same or lower amounts of economic growth is a sign that they've reached the productive limits of the investment-led industrial growth policy. And just to give people some kind of idea, according to the Financial Times article, they say the World Bank has said that investment as a percentage of gross domestic product has for decades hovered around 25% around the world. For high investing countries, it generally varies between 30 and 34%. But in China, it's above 40% and has been for two decades. Now, Pettis argues that it doesn't matter whether this investment is going into something that's obviously had its day, like real estate, and isn't kind of super productive, or something, as he would say, much sexier, i.e. high-tech manufacturing. He said that doesn't matter. He said ultimately it's still excess investment and is not going to get the economic growth needed. The only thing that will do that is switching to more of a rebalancing the economy to privilege consumption more and thereby balance out their production with their consumption. He said that will be painful, but it will ultimately need to happen, and the longer the wait, the worse it will be. So he said it really doesn't matter if they're doing this. It's still a different version of the same failed model. What do you have to say to that, Philip Pilkington?
I mean, it feels to me like the Chinese People's Liberation Army could park a tank in the front of Michael Patterson's house, and he would still say that the economy was going to collapse and the Chinese were going to lose and so on. Like, the Chinese are taking over the world economy, guys. Like, wake up. Okay, they're not going to totally take over the world economy. Europe, like, protectionism, America might increase its tariffs and so on. That will have effects of its own. But China's taking over the world. This is the process of what the economist David P. Goldman calls the signification of the global south. That's exactly what's going on. David P. Goldman has been writing about this stuff for 8 years or 10 years or something. We've always had this kind of view that this was occurring. And Michael Pettis just stumbles, I hate to say it, from one argument to another. Oh, now the housing market's going to crash. Oh, now the high-tech manufacturing isn't going to be sold for some undefined reason. It's like he's got obsessed with a singular idea that the Chinese economy needs to be a consumption-led economy. He's got completely transfixed by that. And he just keeps following through with every development in the actual economy. At some point, the Chinese economy will probably have to become a consumption-led economy. That's just, as per capita income goes up and so on. But they keep hitting their growth targets. Their reach and influence keeps expanding in the world. And Michael Pettis is there looking at the PLA parked on his lawn and saying, no, the Chinese don't have any power. It's all about the collapse. Like, how long can you go on for? Can he go on for another 20 years of, say, 5% target growth hit every year and keep saying China's going to collapse? I don't know.
Yeah, I would just say something about that. I mean, by definition, he is kind of right. I mean, they can't rely on external consumption forever. Otherwise, they will just, eventually the world runs out of consumption, right? Once they've taken over literally everything, in theory, it just expands and expands and expands until there's nothing else to take over, right? And then they'll have to consume something, right? But, with regard to this, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that they have another, decade, two decades of this style of growth, simply because there's so much catch-up growth to be had in the world, and there's so much value that the Chinese can offer in terms of their manufactured goods. I'll give you one example. The Chinese have started selling electric cars in places in Africa for like under $10,000. Okay. Now, Africa's grown at a massive pace. It's, we're always seeing these, we're always seeing these reports about the economic growth of Africa, the potential growth, high levels of year-on-year GDP expansion, demographic growth. Well, could China hook itself into that? Could China provide telecommunications? Can it provide electricity? Can it provide cars? Can it provide batteries? Can it provide solar panels, which I assume would be like really good in Africa, where they have lots of sunshine near the equator and where they don't have existing national grids, where maybe distributed electricity production with solar panels would be good. Yeah, I can imagine that would work out well. You know, as Africans, as Africa generates a middle class, would an electric vehicle that they can charge from their solar panels at home that cost, $10,000 or whatever it is, would that go down well in the country? Yeah, I should imagine it would. You know, I could imagine these all these like rapid growth regions that, if China works on highly productive, highly efficient manufacturing, they could just, as Goldman says, take over those markets essentially. They can essentially assimilate those markets into the Chinese economic sphere. And, even if Pettis is right, by definition, a country cannot literally grow based on exogenous consumption forever. I mean, that's just that's just a fact, okay? There's no arguing with that. I can imagine there being a kind of another leg of Chinese growth available based on their manufactured goods, especially if they start moving up the value chain as it seems that they're doing. And I think the Western press, after all of the kind of the end of China is nigh reporting, is perhaps catching up with that. At the moment, it's with headlines like, will Xi's manufacturing plan be enough to save the Chinese economy? In 6 months, it might be China's experiencing a manufacturing boom. I think that's how this is going to go.
Can I just say really quickly, they're not going to change the people that they quote in the articles. They're completely locked into this little network of commentators and they won't look outside of it. David Goldman's been writing about this stuff for 10 or 15 years. He's got it completely right, doesn't get a look in. And by the way, he used to be a very senior person at Goldman Sachs. So, they don't want to see this.
A bridge too far.
The Francis Stock Key Bridge has fallen down. I'd imagine most listeners have seen it. It was an incredibly dramatic video. A container ship steered itself or lost control or whatever happened. It ended up steering into one of the pillars of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And the moment it hit the pillar, the whole thing just collapsed like a rag doll or something. I mean, it was really dramatic. It was not the kind of scene that I'd have expected. I thought if you kind of, we've seen the kind of Kerch Bridge in Crimea being hit by munitions and so on, and you kind of see a hole and then they have to repair the hole, or they hit it with an exploding speedboat and one of the pillars kind of sags. Like, this thing just crumbled. It was kind of amazing. Not only is the bridge down, but Baltimore Port is basically blocked because that is the entryway to Baltimore Port, and there's a bunch of bridge lying under the sea there. This is a really key port. I mean, actually, listeners may be familiar with it, either if you've ever traveled in and around Washington, D.C., you've probably seen Baltimore Port. The other claim to fame of Baltimore Port is the TV series The Wire. One of the entire seasons was based around Baltimore Port and how it operated and people who worked there and so on. Anyway, the key to this basically is that it's a huge transport hub for America. The New York Post is reporting that the collapse of the bridge threatens $80 billion in cargo. And of course, that travels into the port. And then there's road networks away from the port. I was looking at maps of logistics maps, and it's a very, very key port. There's more than 140,000 jobs tied to shipping traffic in Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore, if anyone's watched The Wire, is a really, really rundown place these days. It's lost a lot of industry. And the one thing that it still had remaining was this port, basically. It's a leading shipping hub for sugar and also for gypsum. Gypsum is used in fertilizer, drywall, plaster, and so on. In 2023, 52.3 million tons of foreign cargo was shipped through Baltimore. So it feels to me like we're going back to this kind of supply chain crisis. The collapse of the Baltimore port will devastate Baltimore, probably, and Maryland, the state. One of my friends pointed out to me, he used to work in D.C., it will probably give rise to an enormous surge in crime as well. And it'll put pressure on American prices, I'd assume. And that's just in the run-up to an election. Also, the scene itself was very vivid, you know, it was very catastrophic. So it's certainly not good for Biden's election prospects. Just really quickly, in terms of fixing the bridge, just prior to this, only a few days ago, about last week, the House of Representatives in Maryland, obviously each state has its own House of Representatives, who actually hold an awful lot of power. People are always looking at the federal level government, but actually the states largely run themselves in the US, and nobody outside the US pays attention to it. They were trying to put through a budget with some difficulty, a $63 billion budget for the next fiscal year. And they were trying to raise $1.3 billion in revenue to fund it. And they were also trying to sell debt. So basically, the takeaway from that is Maryland has a hard time raising $63 billion to spend. The bridge is probably going to cost $10 or $15 billion to fix. Now, Joe Biden has stepped in and pledged emergency federal dollars to fund the entire cost of the bridge. But reports are saying that it's a project that will take years. And if you've ever actually lived in a port city or a city in America with sea access, a lot of the stuff around the sea is very run down. They're not very good at repairing it. I don't know why exactly. They're far less, they seem to be far less competent at repairing their infrastructure, especially their core infrastructure, than we are in Europe. So Baltimore Bridge is probably going to be sunk for a while. I don't know how long it'll take to clear the debris and reopen the port, but we're probably talking weeks, I'd imagine. So huge impacts of this fairly tragic event.
Yeah, I think there are three ways that this can have an effect, or an effect that's relevant to this podcast. The first is, as you said, inflation. My impression so far is that it is a very important port for the US, especially for the Eastern Seaboard. But in terms of things like containers, it's pretty small fry compared with ports farther up the coast. And while it is absolutely crucial for a few things like car exports, it's probably likely that these things will be able to be rerouted fairly quickly. So I can't imagine it having like a huge inflationary effect in the way that during the COVID lockdown, you saw these like huge queues of container ships outside the port of Los Angeles and other similar ports. However, this is just, this might not be a problem in and of itself in ordinary times, but these aren't ordinary times. You've got the Red Sea still heavily disrupted, if not essentially closed, especially for Western US, British, European and Israeli ships. But you've also had recent issues with the Panama Canal as well. And these are, two of the most important maritime sea lanes in the world. And on top of that, in the US, if you have this, even if it's a relatively small effect, or even if it's limited within certain sectors, like, say, car parts or something like that, or gypsum, as you mentioned, then that might still add to the inflationary snowball, if you like. It could still have an effect. I think the second point is politically how this will affect it. We are in an election year at the moment. And listeners will know I try to avoid US politics. And while I am skeptical about the true policy differences that Donald Trump will actually be able to undertake as opposed to what he talks about. I think if you look at the 2016 election campaign and how he actually governed, there was a marked difference, and he governed in a much more orthodox manner than he ran for election. And I do wonder whether it's going to be the same this time, despite the terror and the fear of creeping fascism in America. But at the same time, we are in an election year. How can, this is a really bad look. I mean, like you say, it's difficult for me to kind of make these points at the moment, given I believe I'm right in saying there are 6 or 7 people who are missing, presumed dead, and you know, entire bridge collapsing is a, you know, is a tragedy, especially when it leads to deaths. But it did come down like a box of matches, you know, like it did come down like one of those, you know, matchstick sculptures or buildings that people make as a hobby, where you kind of pull one match away and the whole thing collapses, or like a house of cards where you pull one card away and the whole thing collapses. How long is it going to take the US to rebuild this sort of thing? Like, they don't have a really great record. I mean, we could be talking 2 or 3 years just to clear the channel and to do a feasibility study, right? You know, to produce 800,000 pages of, you know, feasibility studies and EDI and, you know, EDI recommendations and all the rest of it. Or are they going to make a real effort to get this done quickly? You know, this could have a real political effect in terms of the national presidential race. I think that's something that we need to look out for. And on that matter, I think it might have a, you know, an effect on, not a big effect, again, like inflation, but another small effect on American prestige. We're all used to seeing these videos of the Chinese, you know, building a bridge in a day, right? Now, obviously, this is a much more complicated structure. You can't just build that in a day. But if this drags on for years, if we hit like 2030 and the Baltimore Bridge still isn't rebuilt, that's a kind of blow to prestige. That's a kind of blow to how things are looking. And given the other blows to prestige the Americans are facing at the moment, again, that might be an issue. You know, if, you know, a city like Baltimore, which was already down at its heel a little bit and one of the more deprived and sometimes even depraved areas of the US, if that goes even further down in its economic struggles, so close to Washington, and they can't get their act together in terms of rebuilding the bridge, that could be an issue as well. So I think in terms of inflation, I think in terms of its political effect, and in terms of global prestige, this could have a small but significant enough to pay attention to effect on the US. Trust the plan.
So the Congressional Budget Office in the United States, the head of it, Philip Swagel, I think is his name, has said that the U.S. could face a Liz Truss-style market shock as debt soars. Swagel is referring to the fact that U.S. debt is now kind of running out of control. It has been for a while. The deficit's been enormous. We talk about it a lot on the show. Why is this getting attention now? I think because of a silent split within the Democratic Party. I'll get back to that in a moment. But Swagel is just pointing at the obvious, really. According to the CBO, the U.S.'s federal debt pile amounted to $26.2 trillion, or 97% of gross domestic product at the end of last year. So they're closing in on 100% of GDP. Funnily enough, the report on this in the Financial Times blames it on the tax cuts by Donald Trump. I'm sure the tax cuts by Donald Trump increased the deficit, no doubt about that. But really, the big increase in the deficit has been the Inflation Reduction Act by the Biden administration. They obviously don't want to talk about that because it's an election year, and we all have a certain way, apparently, even if most of the readers of this newspaper are in Europe and they don't actually vote. So what is really driving this? Because it's been, you know, it's been fairly obvious for fairly long. Well, let's talk about the debt and the deficit first, and then move on to why the narrative is starting to shift on this. So what's caused the increase in the deficit? Well, deficits and debt have increased since the 2008 financial crisis, just kind of structurally. The economies haven't been as strong. The Keynesian response, the ARRA stimulus, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, passed under Obama, made it very normal to prop up the U.S. economy using fiscal expenditure. In the recovery from 2008, I think that was justified. I'm not a fan of everything that the ARRA spent money on, but it was mainly actually an infrastructure bill with a small green component in comparison to, say, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the exact inverse. It's a giant green energy bill. And since we've just talked about collapsing bridges, people might want to pay more attention to the fact that the green lobby has taken over all fiscal space in DC. It's highly corrupting, in my opinion. But the two other things that blew it out, basically, yes, the Trump tax cuts didn't hurt, although you can't really see the impact of the Trump tax cuts in the deficit. Maybe you can if you squint. But trying to cost tax cuts is notoriously tricky business, whereas trying to cost a spending bill is very simple because there's a line item by line item. The real thing that really blew out the deficits, not just in the US, but elsewhere in the world, was the response to the pandemic. I've disparagingly called it in the past the global pajama party. People spent an absolute fortune. Governments all over the world spent an absolute fortune on that. And we still haven't recovered from it. And we refuse to talk about it. We completely refuse to talk about the sheer amount of money that we spent during that very, very strange period. Feels like we want to sweep the whole thing under the bed and pretend it never happened. Unhealthy, I would say. Then the two other components that have fed into the enormous deficit are spending on the Ukraine war, which is very real. The Americans that are supportive of this spending will say, oh, it's only a very small amount. It's not. It's a pretty big amount. It's into $100 billion, whatever, you know. So that's pretty big. And then, of course, the elephant in the room that the Financial Times pretends does not exist, the Inflation Reduction Act. A crazy policy, in my opinion. A stimulus put forward when the economy was running hot. So you're supposed to run a Keynesian stimulus when there's lots of unemployed workers to be hired. And, you know, Obama put them to work building infrastructure and so on, which I think was pretty good policy. And then Biden comes in as kind of like this, like, degraded, dilapidated Obama and spends a big load of money, not just at a time when there isn't workers to hire and the economy's running hot, but also he spends it on junk, really, in my opinion. Spends it mostly on green energy companies, which I just read as a handout to Democratic Party donors and supporters. You'll see that many people at the heads of these companies have worked for the Democratic Party in some capacity in DC, and that's their transition role. So it's really, it was really a pretty shaky stimulus. So that brings us to the question, why now? We're in the run-up to the election. Why on earth would the press, which doesn't even want to mention the Inflation Reduction Act while talking about the US deficit, why would they want to talk about the fact the US could be broke? It's because I think there's a split emerging in the Democratic Party. I think we saw this with the publication of an academic paper by Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury, on the high inflation in the US. We won't go into it now. We might cover it next week or something. But basically, Larry Summers said inflation was much higher than it was measured as. And this tells us why the discontent with the electorate is so deep. This is why Biden keeps polling badly on the economy, even though standard metrics say the economy is doing pretty well. I think this crowd have got the upper hand. Some of them have scored to settle. I want to point that out. Larry Summers famously did not get the Federal Reserve job because Janet Yellen got it. Janet Yellen got it on riding a progressive wave at the time that was interested in financial regulation. And she was not a front runner. She was not a favorite. But she rode that wave very carefully. And that wave was very highly activist people. And they attacked Larry Summers for making comments about women and the sciences or something when he was Harvard president. And they kind of, I won't say they destroyed his career, but they really took him down a few pegs. And that was how Janet Yellen got in. So I can imagine that he's not particularly keen on Janet Yellen. He's also, I will say, a much better economist than Janet Yellen. Larry Summers, whatever you think of policies that he's put in place, the Rubin guys and all these, he is a genuinely good economist. So Larry Summers has a bit of an axe to grind in that direction. And I think he sees an opportunity now. They have these desperately bad poll numbers. They're probably going to lose this election, mainly on the economy. And so the centrist Democrats, the adults in the room, as it were, around Summers and so on, are trying to grab the mantle from the progressives who first put Obama in, Yellen, all these people, but also ultimately Joe Biden, although he was an odd candidate for the progressives to back. So these guys are trying to grab the microphone back, but ultimately, in terms of reforms and so on, it's too late. The money's been spent. You can't unspend it now. I think it'll be very, very difficult for the United States to wind in its debt load, even its deficit, much less its debt load. Now, we can talk about the implications of that. Can the United States go broke, or can they have a crisis of the type that occurred in the UK when Liz Truss tried to spend money? But I think that's the broad overview of the politics and the numbers behind it. I think it's probably a good thing that the US is finally taking this seriously. But I strongly suspect that this will peter out and will continue to have structurally high deficits, debt, and so on. We haven't even got a recession yet. Once we get a recession, that deficit's really going to blow out, probably into the mid-teens as a percentage of GDP.
Yeah, I must admit, I had to laugh when Liz Truss was specifically cited as the reference point for a kind of financial crisis, a debt buyer's strike, that is, because I think most people will have seen her at the US NatCon conference, the National Conservative Conference, being interviewed by the by Steve Bannon, the nefarious and Machiavellian Steve Bannon, talking about some of her ideas, some of the things that she likes to ideas she would like to introduce in terms of governance, and of course one of the big things with her short-lived premiership was the mini financial crisis in Britain, and now people are talking about that in the US as well. On a serious note, I think this might sound strange to a lot of people, but I actually think in theory the US has got loads of room to take on more debt. I don't think the debt in and of itself is a big issue. I really don't. If you look at various historic cases, the US at the end of the Second World War had loads of debt. Britain during the Second World War and even the Napoleonic Wars had loads of debt. The big issue with the US is, or let's say two issues. The first is a kind of technical issue, and that's that it's at the same time it's running this big fiscal deficit, which, by the way, I see as equally Biden and Trump's and Obama's and George W. Bush's fault. It's all of them essentially have been living high on the hog for far too long. The problem is that they're doing this at the same time as they're running a current account deficit, which has to be funded. So some of this debt is, or their ability to keep running these kind of twin current account and fiscal deficits, is reliant on the kindness of foreigners, the willingness of foreigners to invest their money in the US. And while there might not be too many options as a kind of ultra-safe asset now, that doesn't necessarily always have to be the case, which brings us on to the second point. And my view is it's not the overall debt that's the concern. It's the image that the US doesn't have a political system that can deal with this seriously. If it obviously had a highly responsible and highly effective political class, then I think it could double its debt from here without running into any stoppers, maybe. But it manifestly doesn't on two levels. First of all, both the parties want to do their stuff without paying the cost of doing their stuff. Trump wanted to reduce corporation tax and reduce tax, income tax overall, especially on high earners. And he wasn't willing, or the Republican Congress, I guess, at least, was not willing to cut spending at a commensurate level. They weren't willing to take the political hit from that. Equally, Biden has splurged enormous amounts of money on his Inflation Reduction Act and also aid to Ukraine. I mean, by the way, people think it's not that much we're sending to Ukraine. It's more in inflation adjusted levels. It's more than the US gave to the Soviet Union during the entirety of the Second World War and the Lend-Lease Act during the Second World War. The combined amount that Europe and the US have sent, of which the US has taken the lead, is more than the Marshall Plan that reconstructed Europe at the end of the Second World War in inflation, adjusted terms. So people who say it's not much, it is a large amount, a massive amount. But really, the Inflation Reduction Act and Ukraine, and Biden hasn't been willing to raise taxes at a commensurate amount or cut spending elsewhere at a commensurate amount. And it's manifestly obvious that both sides are willing to act in this relatively irresponsible way. But the most concerning thing in terms of political risk in the US at the moment is the willingness of both sides to play chicken with the federal debt ceiling and the federal budget and to shut down the federal government. It's like, not only are they acting in a fiscally profligate way, the way that the Peronist governments traditionally acted in Argentina, but in addition to that, they're acting in a way that is really quite worrying in terms of their willingness to play chicken with the entire financial system, the entire American economy, these constant standoffs over the lockdown, the fact they never pass a proper budget, they just pass these kind of continuing bills for 6 months. This is not a sign of political common sense. And I think that's really what it is, which is going to start putting the brakes on the US in terms of its debt.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The issue here isn't the capacity to fund the domestic deficit. I mean, the modern monetary theory people are correct. If you issue your own currency, you can't go broke in your own currency. I think it's absolutely, as you're saying, the centrist Democrats see two risks on the horizon. One is political, as you say. America's standing in the world is not what it used to be, and it seems to be declining by the day. And having this lunatic amount of debt and spending and profligacy and stuff isn't the good luck. But also, I think they are actually concerned with the current account not being financed, the current account deficit not being financed. I mean, a certain amount of government debt that's issued every year is issued to foreign buyers. Net issuance of government debt treasuries would be issued to foreign buyers. And there used to be a pretty healthy market for that. It used to be pretty deeply liquid. You issue the stuff, they buy it. And that was the other side of the trade deficit. That was, you know, the Chinese buying up this debt, snapping it up to cycle the reserves that they were getting from running a trade surplus with the US. By all accounts, the market, the foreign market for US treasuries right now is not very liquid. And that's why they're referring to the Liz Truss thing. The Liz Truss event happened at a time when the UK treasury market, one hedge fund manager told me at the time that it was trading like an emerging market debt, an emerging markets government debt market. Very illiquid, hard to sell into the market and so on. And I think the US is starting to feel some of these pressures. Reports suggest that this is probably the beginning of de-dollarization, the reason that this is occurring. While people aren't en masse switching out of the dollar, although that is happening to some extent, but while we haven't seen that, they're not buying dollars at the margin, let's put it that way. So they're not currently saying we need to shift all our assets out of the dollar. That's what everyone's watching. The reality is, if you see an illiquid foreign market for US Treasury debt, that's the beginning of de-dollarization, where they go, well, we may not switch our entire asset pool, but we're certainly not taking more of that asset. And so I think the smarter people like Larry Summers, who is very, very well connected on Wall Street in Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and the investment banks, he'll be told this. He'll have the same information on this that we have, because he's a smart guy and he's well connected and so on. So people will tell him about this illiquidity. He'll know that there's this talk of de-dollarization in the air, and he'll put two together. Now, they won't say that explicitly. This would be a bad idea. If I was him, I wouldn't say it explicitly either. But they know this. They know this in their bones. And so I think what they're really saying is, we could be facing a world where the rest of the world doesn't accept this dollar debt anymore. That may be developing as we speak. We may get there by 2030. We need to get our fiscal house in order. But, you know, as you laid out there with the, you know, both sides willing to be reckless and so on, no appetite for reform, fantasy thinking, people not really thinking in terms of the economy, all this kind of like thinking in terms of messaging and what makes the poll numbers go up and what makes them go down. I don't see anything on the horizon of the US reining in its debt load. So it probably will be that the foreign markets have to put an end to this. And what that will mean, just in concrete terms, is a decline in the value of the dollar, a decline in purchasing power by American citizens, and a rise in standard of living. So you won't have access to the cheaper Chinese goods anymore, the cheaper Vietnamese goods at those prices. It'll be an elevated price. So I think that's where we're moving. I hope that more sensible people like Larry Summers and so on do get more influence and convince people to tamp this down and rein in a new kind of sense of responsible government in Washington, D.C. But would anyone really bet on that? We have the November election coming up. Would it really be a good idea to put $10 on the table and say by 2030, America's going to have this extremely cohesive, responsible governing class, and all the tensions will melt away? No, probably not. And so these warnings are probably warnings that will be written in the future into a history book.